So last week we started a new sermon series, and we're calling it The Heart of the Matter. And we're using some of the stories of David in the Bible just to talk about character and integrity. So if you remember, some of you who were here, like back in November, we did a little sermon series on how to read the Bible, right? Just a little three-parter. And in that, I used a couple of stories from the book of Daniel. And I had a couple of people just express some surprise that Daniel probably wasn't a real person, right? He may have been based on a historical figure passed down through oral tradition, but probably very loosely if that is the case. And so I thought you might be pleased or reassured to know that David in the Bible was almost certainly a real figure. He was an Israelite king. He lived about 1,000 years BCE. Recent archaeological evidence has confirmed the kingdoms of Saul and David. So most of the stories that we find about David are found in the books of 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 Chronicles, and then he wrote many of the Psalms are attributed to him. So 1 and 2 Samuel is actually, you know, one big book. It's just Samuel. But back when these things were written on scrolls, they got too big for the scrolls, so they had to divide them into two. So that's why we have broken that into two books. Samuel and Chronicles are a little bit different from each other. I would say that 1 and 2 Samuel it's a little bit more raw, you might say. There's some like discrepancies in the text. There's even some crassness in them. People like David are shown with these very human flaws. I love the stories in Samuel. Chronicles is a little bit more of like the cleaned up official government version. And so if you read them both, you'll see those contrasts there. But what is clear when you read them is that David, with all of his faults, was a beloved figure, right? And so his story is the longest narrative account of anybody else's in the entire Bible. And so I thought, gosh, I think in 15 to 20 years, I've maybe only preached on David once. So that's why I thought maybe we'll use his stories. They're some of the best ones to talk about integrity here. So last week we started with the story of David and Goliath, probably the most well-known one, right, to just illustrate the importance of being true to ourselves, right, the idea that integrity starts with not trying to be something we're not. And this week I want to talk a little bit about what it means to have integrity under pressure. So we start to see these stories of David when he's a kid and when he's in his teen years. And it kind of seems like he lived a bit of a charmed life. And I thought you could probably make an interesting argument that he was a little bit of maybe like the lost child in his family system, if that's interesting to you, right? The sibling that was overlooked. When he was quite young, there was a prophet named Samuel who came to his house, and he said to David's dad, "Look, one of your sons is going to be the next king. I'm here to anoint him." And so David's dad paraded out his 7 older brothers, one after another, before the prophet. And then each one, the prophet Samuel said, "Nope, God says not that one. Nope, not that one. Nope, not that one." And then he finally says to David's dad, "Do you have any more sons?" And David's dad's like, "No. Well, I guess I do have one more." He's out in the fields with the sheep. You know, like he forgot about the littlest one. And it made me wonder if the youngest siblings in really big families maybe can relate a little bit to that story. All right, so David is an athletic kid. He's used to spending time on his own. All right, he's hanging out and about in the hills around Jerusalem, tending sheep. He fights off animals with his slingshot. He sings and he plays his harp in the hills to entertain himself. He just sounds kind of delightful. Right now he's found out that he's going to be the next king of Israel. And at this point, I'm not sure he really fully understands the ramifications of that, right? Sort of the kind of danger that could place him in with the current king, should that king find out. But for right now, he's kind of a golden boy. And this is even more true after he saves the nation by slaying the giant Goliath, right? Right after he kills Goliath, it's like life gets even better for this guy for a time. Right, so first he starts becoming pals with the king's son, right? So he's like pals with the prince, Jonathan. They become very good friends, probably eventually lovers. I'll touch on that relationship in a different sermon. But this is from 1 Samuel 18. It says, "Jonathan stripped himself of the robe that he was wearing, and he gave it to David, and his armor, and even his sword, and his bow, and his belt." Right, so in this, symbolically, we see Jonathan like basically handing all of his royal garb to David, right? It's letting the reader know here that David is the actual next real king, and Jonathan knows it and is already honoring that, right? So then it says, "David went out and he was successful wherever Saul sent him. And as a result, Saul set him over the army, and all of the people, even the servants of Saul, approved. And as they were coming home, when David returned from killing the Philistine, Goliath, it says, the women came out of all of the towns of Israel, singing and dancing, to meet King Saul with tambourines and with songs of joy and with musical instruments. And the women sang to one another as they made merry, Saul has killed his thousands and David his tens of thousands, right? And it says, Saul was very angry. This displeased him. They have ascribed to David 10,000s and to me ascribed thousands, right? Like that's a little fragile there. But he says, what more can he have but the kingdom? And so Saul eyed David from that day on. Right? So David here, he's pals with the prince. He is a hero to the nation. He is doing everything the king asks him to do, and it is turning out well for him. It says everybody approves. Flocks of women are chanting his name in the streets. He's the head of the army. Everybody loved him. 1 Samuel 18, David had success in all of his undertakings, for the Lord was with him. And when Saul saw that he had great success, he stood in awe of him. But all of Israel and Judah loved David, for it was he who marched out and came in leading them. Right, so the people loved him. Saul's daughter, Michal, also loved David. I actually think it's the only place in the Hebrew scriptures where a woman is said to explicitly love a man. Right? I think it can be inferred in the Song of Songs. I think it can be inferred in Ruth and some other places, but it's the only place where it says Michal loved David. And we're also told Jonathan loved David. Right? So two of the king's children and all of the nation's people loved him. So of course that's leading to the king's jealousy. Right? So he now wants to kill David outright, but he's in this pickle because he knows if he does that, the people are going to hate him for it. And so Jonathan sees this in him, and he's starting to intercede with his dad. Right? He's trying to convince him, look, David doesn't mean you any harm. Please leave my friend alone. That doesn't work. And then Michal, who's now David's wife, she starts to learn that he's actually in immediate danger, and so she helps him to escape from the palace. So it says she dressed him in disguise. It's something about like goat hair. There's some like parallels with the Jacob Esau story that we won't go into, but she's like covered him in all of these different sort of costumes, and David climbs out their window in the night, and then Michal took an idol and she placed it into their bed so that people would think that David was there sleeping in it. It's like classic palace intrigue, right? And what had happened was Saul had started throwing spears at David, right? While David played the harp, and then while David wasn't playing the harp. And I think at this point, we can start to just note that the weapons in the story become a literary device in the narrative, and they start to communicate about power and about rightful authority. Like, who gets to wield the weapons? How do they use them? Do they use the spears and the swords for violence, or do they choose to refrain from using them? That's something to pay attention to in the text, right? And so at this point in the story, another weapon re-enters the narrative. So David, right, it's like the camera pans. David has just escaped from the palace in disguise, and so now we're following him. And as he's running, he goes up to a little place northeast of Jerusalem. He takes refuge in a synagogue there. He had fled so quickly that he didn't have any food and he didn't have any weapons with him. And so he goes to this priest in the synagogue, Ahimelech, and he asks for something to eat. The problem was there wasn't any like ordinary bread in the synagogue. There was only consecrated bread. It was like holy bread. And so the priest, he knew David's name by reputation, right? He's like, I know who this guy is. This guy lives in the palace. He's married to the king's daughter. And so he's a little bit afraid to give it to him to eat because he's wondering, is David going to go tell someone that he misused this holy bread? And then he asks David, he's like, why are you here alone? Right? He's wondering, were you sent here as a spy to like get me in trouble? So David lies to him. We see a little foreshadowing of some guile in him. And he says that he was on a secret mission from the king that had to be kept under wraps, right? So the priest gives him bread. But then to heighten the tension in the story, David realizes, he looks around the synagogue, and he realizes that there is the head of the king's shepherd is there. And this is great. The guy's name is Doug, right? So I got a cousin named Doug, so that's who I'm thinking of. But only it's D-O-E-G, right? So Doug is in the temple. And so David's looking at there, he's like, oh man, this guy's going to know who I am. This could be trouble. So he's the one that's scared now. right? So he goes and he asks this priest, he's like, is there a spear or a sword in the building? He's like, look, I left the palace without one. The king's business required haste. Well, it turned out in this story that the sword of Goliath the giant happened to find its way into this synagogue and was being kept there. Right? This is probably just a little literary thing going on. Right? So when the priest offered it to David, David answered, well, there's none like it. Give it to me. And I think this is meant to be a pivot point in the story, right? Because we remember from last week that when David went to fight Goliath, he was too young to even carry like Saul, the king's armor and spear, right? Remember, the king had given him his armor, he'd given his spear and his sword, and David couldn't even walk in it. It was all too big, it was all too heavy. David was a projectile warrior, right? He used a slingshot. He didn't wear armor. He didn't carry big weapons. Well, if Saul's sword was too heavy for him, then surely the giant Goliath's sword was too heavy, because Goliath was said to be 8 feet tall, right? But here we are seeing that David is no longer a child, right? He's grown up. I think this is symbolic of that turning point. He's not a boy anymore. He is a man now. There's a rabbi, David Wolpe, says this. He says, as we imagine him unsheathing it, there is a clear Excalibur theme, right? The one who can wield this sword is a full warrior to be feared, right? So David accepts this sword. We have no record of him ever using it, but we know that he has it. It's this marker of his status, of his maturation. His refusal to use it against his own king is a symbol of his restraint. And in contrast to that, Saul freely uses his spear and his sword to try and kill David everywhere, all the time. Right, so word has spread really quickly that David has fled the palace. And so David's family soon finds him and joins him, because after all, the king probably would have killed them anyway. And then he was joined as well by about 400 other men. And this story tells us that these were men who were in dire straits. These were people who were deep in debt, people who were embittered with the current regime. And so David here, he's drawing the poor and he's drawing the discontent around him. And so as they're going out through the countryside, Saul and his army started to chase David and these men to try and kill them. And so at this point, there are two stories that we see where the tables start to be turned. And David actually has two chances to kill Saul. Right, so David, the first one, David and his men, they're camped out in some caves that's over by the Dead Sea. So if you know anything about the Dead Sea, it's the lowest place on earth, it's salt water, it's kind of out in the middle of the desert. I've swam in it. If I can float, anybody can float in that thing. You can see all the way to the bottom because it's so salty, absolutely nothing grows in there. But next to it, there's like a bunch of cliffs and hills and things, and there's a little spring that comes down, and that spring is called Ein Gedi. So it would have been a good place to go because you'd need to like have fresh water for these 400 men, and it's a place to hide, and it's up high, right? So from this height, David and his men would have been able to see Saul and these 3,000 troops like coming at them from miles away. So David and his guys, they see Saul and these troops coming, and they're like, you know what we're going to do? We're just going to hide really deep in these caves, right? These are like the caves where like the Dead Sea Scrolls are, close to it, right? So they go down into them deep, and we're told that King Saul happened to wander into the mouth of the very cave where David himself was hiding, and we're told he had gone in to relieve himself. That story is not in Chronicles, right? Chronicles is Samuel made boring. But in this one, Saul's having a wee. And we're told David stealthily came up and cut off a piece of his cloak while he was in this very vulnerable position. But even though he didn't hurt Saul, David was immediately remorseful of what he had done. And he quietly went back and told his men, oh, God forbid I should have even done that. And so Saul leaves the cave, none the wiser that any of this had happened. And we're told that David went after him. And so he yells, he's like, my lord, the king. And so Saul looked at him. And David got on his knees, and he put his face onto the ground, and it says, why are you listening to the people who are telling you that I want to harm you? Look, I could have killed you just now. My men wanted me to. I had compassion. Look, I've got a piece of your cloak. Why are you chasing me? I'm like a dead dog. I'm like a small flea. I am nothing to you. And it says Saul was moved, and so temporarily he repented, and he stopped chasing David for half a second or so. But very soon, he was back to his favorite hobby of murder. And so that was the first story. And the second story, as Saul very quickly turns back to murder two chapters later, we see in this story, Saul is asleep in his tent. And his spear, right? Remember, he had his spear by him. It was stuck in the ground by his head, and it was next to a water jug. And we see David creep into the tent. And instead of taking Saul's spear and killing him with it, instead he takes it and he takes the water jug and he walks away. And then we have a parallel scene to what we had two chapters back. David's like, look, Saul, I could have killed you and I didn't. Why are you chasing me? And then he actually takes Saul's spear and he gives it back to him. 1 Samuel 26, David replied, here is the spear, O king. Let one of the young men come over and get it. The Lord rewards everyone for his righteousness and his faithfulness. The Lord gave you into my hand today, but I would not raise my hand against the Lord's anointed. And so David once again refused to use not only his own weapon against Saul, but also he disarms Saul and gives his weapons back. All right, so I think through these stories of David's time here in the wilderness, of his time as a child, where we're seeing him as sort of a golden boy and then into the wilderness, we see it start out with the kind of life that I think most of us hope that we had as kids, or the kind of life we hope to give our kids and our grandkids and our nieces and our nephews and the children of our friends, right? You see, David starts out and there's no danger really in his life. And he grew up as a young man who was safe. He was beloved in his community. He was appreciated for the gifts he brought, celebrated for his talents. He was just generally embraced. Everybody loved this guy. And then he hit that point that we want to shield ourselves from, we want to shield kids from for as long as possible, that point where you realize life can sometimes be really hard, right? And in David's case, it was when somebody in power was threatened by him. Right, and that's when David had some basics just sort of subtracted from his charmed life. He wasn't safe. He had to flee. He had no food or resources. He had to figure out how to survive out there on his own in the wilderness. He's isolated. He had to build new friendships, new allies. You know, that part makes me think sometimes, like, I know many of us here have like kind of felt like exiled from a lot of churches, and we feel like we're kind of in the wilderness, having to find new friends and new allies, and you do start to find those things out in the wilderness, right? And so we read David's story, and there's things to relate to, I think. As we read through it, it invites us to ask, okay, how is David going to react to all of these complications he's facing, right? That's what we're meant to watch. Does this guy have resilience? Can he develop the kind of grit and character that's going to see him through these hardships? Does he have what it takes to be a true leader? And I think at this point in the story, we're meant to come away with, yes, actually I see it. This guy's got some integrity. And the things that we're seeing is we're seeing him learn to be scrappy, right? He's got to learn to use his resources wisely. We didn't look at this story today, but there is a little piece in there where, you know, David's got these 400 men that he's now in charge of. And he's like, how do I feed them? And so he comes up with this idea. He's like, well, you know, we could be like a security team. And so he and his men go out and they provide security for shepherds and sheep in return for food. You know, and he could have just killed those shepherds. He could have killed the sheep. He could have just taken all of the food, but that wasn't his way. In fact, he operated with so much integrity that later on in the story, those shepherds come to his defense and they say, look, we really respect this guy. He treated us well. David had to rely on other people. And many of those people were unlikely friends for a golden boy and a future king, right? He's got a ragtag group of people who are down on their luck, and those people became family for him. And you've got all these other little characters that come in. He had to rely on a scared priest. He had to rely on some local shepherds, right? His limits were tested out there in the wilderness. I think in the same way that our limits and our character get tested when we start to face adversity and pressure, it's so much easier to do the right thing when we have enough, right? When everything is going well. But the question becomes, what do we do when we face hardship? What kind of person do we want to be, right? In this story, it's David is asking, what kind of man do I want to be? What kind of king do I want to be? What kind of person? So David, I think, discovered what he was willing to do and what he wasn't willing to do out there to secure his own safety and position. Right? He had it on good authority that he was meant to be the next king, but he was not willing to use violence to get there. He wasn't willing to kill Saul, and you know what? He may not have even realized that until he was face to face with the opportunity to do it. And I think that's just like we may or may not know how we react to different things when there's till there's pressure put on us in our marriages, in our jobs, with our kids. And I think the story we can take from this is that's the time to ask, what kind of person do I want to be? And I think this could also just be a good week to remind ourselves that using violence to obtain power is not a mark of integrity in our tradition. It's not a mark of integrity in this story. Right? 4 years ago, we did not have a peaceful transfer of power. With God's good grace, we will this week. We saw Saul repeatedly misuse his power, symbolized by his weapon, his willingness to do violence. And we see David repeatedly using power with integrity, refusing violence, even when it was somewhat justifiable. And the interesting thing is we'll follow this along a little bit later in his career, because he does violate his own values later, right? He violates them to his own shame, right? When he's got more to lose. But here in his ascendancy story, I think what this is meant to show us is the core of his heart, the values that he actually aspires to. And then later, when we see him violate those, we can take a look at, like, what was it that made him vulnerable to doing that? What was it that made him vulnerable to corruption? Because we are all vulnerable. And so I think we're just cautioned as readers in this beginning part of our story to guard those values, guard those things that we hold most true for ourselves, and make sure that we're living in alignment with those. And if you skip into the later on in the story, you know, you've got Saul and his spear that he keeps trying to use to do violence. We know the end of his story is he dies by falling on his own spear, right? But the very weapon that he used to try and do violence and to misuse his kingship and his leadership ultimately was what destroyed him. All right, so that's kind of an interesting follow the weapons here. All right, so with that, I'm going to do a little meditation. Sometimes we just do silence, but I thought this morning, I just ask a couple of questions to yourself if you would like to. People make noise, there'll be some noise, but just maybe ask, what are your core values? Like, what are the things that you want to believe about yourself to be true, that you think are really important to who you are, and do you feel like you're living in alignment with those values? And I'll just give us a couple of minutes to just sort of see what kind of conversation with God kind of comes from this. Amen and amen.